Hi, everybody. My name's Carol, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am truly grateful to be here. Before I came up, Robin came and gave me a hug, and she says, just remember we love you. And that's what I found in this program is unconditional love, and I'm just truly grateful. I want to thank all the committee members for everything that they've done. When Tanya called me, gosh, close to a year ago and asked me to speak, my first thought was, oh, you have the wrong person. And that's old tapes. That's the old me that I'm not good enough or any of that. And in AA they say yes if you can. You know, sometimes there's times when you can't, like if there's a death or something, but I always try to say yes when I can. And we were sitting down here being extremely nervous, and I asked Lori if she knew CPR, and she says, no, but I know how to throw a glass of water on you. and then Dawn and I were talking, too, and how, you know, you kind of fidget when you're nervous, and I just thought, well, at least we're, you know, she says, otherwise we wouldn't be here if we weren't sober. So that's true, I wouldn't. I probably wouldn't even be alive if I wasn't sober now. I guess, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was born into an alcoholic family. It wasn't until I got sober that I realized that probably didn't matter for me. I was me no matter what family I was in. And I remember a lot of fighting, a lot of anger, and a lot of booze. My dad always left his glasses of bourbon and ginger ale, and I would always just gulp them down. And my mom and dad would have me bring beers to them, and I always got the first sip off of them. I didn't really like beer, but that, you know, if that's what they had at the time, then that was it. And we had wine with dinner a lot, and they always had pitchers of martinis mixed up in the fridge, and it seemed like alcohol was always there. And from the time I was born, I think I always felt that there was something wrong with me. I wasn't enough. If I could do something different, I wasn't happy with me. I drew pictures of, when I was little, I drew pictures of people with square heads and tears coming out of their eyes. And my mom said that she told my dad that I was sick, that I needed help. And when you're in an alcoholic home, nobody gets help. You know, you don't even talk about it. And growing up, I would sneak into the fridge and take gulps of those martinis, and it burned all the way down. And I liked it when I was even in third grade. I liked how it made me feel. I was kind of a loner as a child, and that kind of helped me. I had I read a lot too. That I think that was kind of another fantasy world for me. I would read and I would sneak, and I would try to stay out of the way, and all the fighting, and when you put two alcoholic parents together and there's fighting all the time, and I had a sister and two brothers also, and my mom and dad were screaming and yelling at each other and always calling each other honey, and to this day I have never called my husband honey because it just seemed so, you know, so contradictory. And so my nickname for my husband is Silly, and I know it sounds stupid, but that's that was just how I have to deal with my life. And when I was in ninth grade, my dad was a professor at the university and at Eastern Michigan University, and I lived in Ann Arbor, and he had an opportunity to be exchange professor, so we went over to England for a year, and there you're allowed to drink when you're 14, and that was when I pretty much started drinking daily with my mom. I'd come home and I'd do my homework and stuff, and she'd be there, and she said her dad always had the saying, it's got to be 5 o'clock somewhere, and we would drink. I heard that a lot when I came in. You know, that wasn't only my grandfather's thing. That and so her and I, it kind of started a new phase on our relationship. My sister didn't drink. My brothers were probably younger, and I was always the bad one. My mom and dad had lots of parties, and some of the dysfunction. We lived in this little tiny condo thing, and the people next door were having a party, so my brother, who's in kindergarten, calls the cops on them. And then he gets a butcher knife and chases us around the house, you know. And that seems, and then we shut the kitchen off, and there was a cubbyhole thing, couldn't get through. But we were just four kids who just didn't have a clue on what life was all about. And that was, I was in ninth grade when we were there, and I discovered boys and booze. I went to an all-girls school, and I thought I was in heaven. Another addiction was probably men at that time. I was always trying to find somebody that would make me whole, something that would make me a whole person, because I just knew that there was something wrong with me and I wasn't a whole person. I didn't know it was a spiritual thing, something from the inside. And that was like the beginning of the end for me. We spent the year over there, and then we came back, and I just was wild. I drank every day. When I went into 10th grade, my sister was a senior, and she drove to school, and we'd all meet at my house, and we'd go through my mom and dad's liquor cabinet, and we'd get a peanut butter jar, and we'd pour a little bit of everything in, and we'd drink it on the way to school every day. And I don't think I got any credit at all for 10th grade, because I ended up skipping all my classes, and when I turned 16, I had a key made for my sister's car, and so we'd get loaded, and then she'd park, and then go to school, and then we'd all go out, meet at her car, I had the key, and we'd go drive around and get loaded, and then how she found out was I was driving up to drop everybody off, and she was sitting on the front steps of the school. She had missed a dentist appointment. And she never told my parents. And I remember one time coming back and trying to fit between two cars in the parking lot, and there wasn't enough room, so I ripped all the molding off on both sides. And I think I told my dad I did it in a parking structure or something later on. I don't really remember. When after 10th grade, you know, when you don't get any credit when you're in high school, you're supposed to take summer school. So I did summer school for a little while, and my family just knew that if I would get help, then, you know, then our family would be okay. And so they made me start going to see a psychiatrist, and they would see a social worker at the same time. And it turned out that they decided that it was a family disease, that they, even though my dad didn't, my father has passed away, but my mother to this day does not believe she has a drinking problem. And what they decided was that it was all of our deal. So we would go and sit in this room, and we would have like family fights. And it was, I guess in some ways it was kind of enlightening. But I wasn't ready. You know, I was just at the beginning of my terror years. My sister, you know, she got loaded and drunk a lot too, but I guess my parents didn't know that, because we used to hang out with the same people, and we'd go, go party on Friday nights, and everybody's hanging out of the window throwing up, you know, and that's how you knew you had a good time. And then when I was going into 11th grade, that's when I had a real problem with going to class. I thought I didn't have to do that, and I ended up getting busted for forging call slips, and they said, if you have to go to those lengths, why don't you just quit school? So I quit school, and then, I don't know, my parents did the best they could back then. They somehow managed to get me into this school. It was called Earthworks. It was, if anybody ever saw that movie Billy Jack, it was a school just like that. It was a free school, and we drank with the teachers. We drank and used with the teachers. I got a diploma from them. One of my classes was massage class. We had cooking class, and our Wednesdays were we would go to different bars. And there was this one bar called the Blind Pig that we would go and drink pitchers at lunchtime. And in Ann Arbor at that time, the drinking age was 18. But they never checked ID. So anyway, I finally did. I did turn. Well, before I went into the school, I was 17, and I just told my parents that I was leaving. I just couldn't. I had run away twice. Slept in the bushes at the Arboretum, which is a place like Pioneers Park in Lincoln. And I just knew it was all their fault. You know, if my parents would leave me alone, if everybody would leave me alone, I would be fine. And I didn't know that that wasn't true. I always thought that it was somebody else's fault. I never took any responsibility for anything I ever did, and I never faced anything without being stoned or drunk. And when I was in high school, that's when I was introduced to the other, you know, the drugs and all that. And drinking always does a lot faster, though. But I liked anything that would alter me, anything that would make me feel differently. And I thought that was the real me, what I was under the influence. And it was a series of different men, you know, different people. I worked for my grandparents, so I was enabled a lot in that way. If I was too loaded or too drunk to go in, my sister would work for me. And then when I did move out, I lived in a house with 9 other people, and it was a total party house. That's all we did. Some of us worked, some of us didn't. I worked, and I did, you know, I went to school, if you can call it that. And then probably when I was about 19, I ended up moving into a different location and found the man of my dreams. He was my first husband. He was a drug dealer, and he always knew I had an alcohol problem. He always knew I had a problem, but I didn't care. I just, you know, I was with that man for about 7 years, and it was a kind of a violent relationship. It was sick. There's no other way to describe it. I'm gonna cry. The one beautiful thing I got out of it was a daughter. My daughter's here today, and she's 19, and I'm truly grateful. You know, they say something good comes out of everything bad, and if that was the only thing I got, it was all worth it. So I was with this person for lots of years, doing lots of blaming. I came from Michigan because he was a drug dealer, and, you know, they have the ditch weed, and so we picked that and took it back. And I always drank all along. And he one of the reasons he had me come out here is because he knew I had a problem, and he wanted me to get away from back in Ann Arbor where, you know, all the bad stuff was. But, you know, wherever I went, I was still there. And I never realized that until I read that story in the big book. I think it was like the first day I was sober where this woman, she goes, everywhere I went, I took myself with me. And, you know, that was it. I thought if I could do this different, if I could do that different, then I would be okay. And I didn't know that that wasn't true. I was always looking on the outside for different things. And then anyway, my first husband, he ended up going back to Michigan. At that time, I had my daughter, and I was afraid. I had never been. I was afraid before for myself, but when you put a little baby into the mix, and you're afraid for their life too, then I did something different. And I truly believe that the only thing that got me through that was by getting drunk. I worked at Kawasaki, and there was a woman there that I probably haven't seen for 18 years, but she would see me come to work with the bruises and that, and she always was nice to me, and she says, you know, if you ever need a place to go, then, you know, you can live with me. And it came down to that. I saw her at work, and I moved out. I lived way in that little place out past Adams, and we got our stuff, and we left, and we lived in a little trailer in Gaslight Village for 4.5 years, and I was working at Kawasaki at the time, full-time, and I thought everybody either got loaded or drank in the morning, and then that's all I did at night. And of course, I found another man who was very similar to that. We just kind of, like, he was kind of straight, though. He's the person that I never would have looked at. I always liked the, you know, my first husband was a biker, you know, the you know, anybody that looked dangerous and creepy, and that was what I was attracted to. Which tells you how sick I am. And he was kind of a straight guy, but he drank, and he drank a lot like I did. And so we started dating, and our first date was I took my daughter and he took his nephew, and we went to an auto show at Pershing Auditorium, and then we took a lot of breaks together at work, and little by little we ended up, I don't know, you know, he moved in. And at my invitation, and our lives revolve, like we take my daughter to the daycare and we'd go to work and we'd come home and I would get off before him and I would usually buy two bottles of wine on the way home and I would drink as much of the first one as I could, and if I heard him coming, even if it was a little bit, I'd dump the rest out quick, put it in the garbage can and bury it up, and I'd go, look, I got a bottle of wine for us to drink with dinner. And so he really had no idea how much I was drinking, but he was drinking a lot. He drank vodka and beer, and finances were not real good at that point, and so he drank a lot of beer, and I didn't like beer. But so he would drink, I would open a fresh one, and I would drink the top half while it's still really cold, and when it starts to get warm, then he would drink the bottom half for me. So what a guy, huh? And then he drank vodka, and he used to say he was sterilizing himself from the inside out. That way he never got sick. And that was our life. And then I got pregnant, and we weren't married, and so I had a child and with this man, so we now had two kids, and we thought it was so cool because we put them in a little walker, and we put the beer can there, and they would, you know, we have all these pictures of our kids with beer. I have a picture of my daughter when she was like 5 weeks old. My mom had brought a gallon of white wine with her when she came to stay with me, and we had her propped up on this gallon of white wine. Oh. And then we also put her in a frying pan, too. We thought that was kind of cute. But then we ended up having, we had another child, and we just drank. You know, everybody that we hung around with drank like we did. And it was... after we'd been, well, when I think when our son was about a year old, my sister-in-law started, she had a daycare, and our one babysitter had quit, and so Nita started watching our children for us, and because she had a daycare, and Katie was like probably almost four by then, and Ricky was almost two, and well, she watched them from the time they were one to three, and she, my husband had a definite drinking problem, and everybody knew that. And I knew that too, and she would always leave Alcoholics Anonymous literature in the diaper bag, because she was, so I like to joke that I was 12-step by a diaper bag, which is really true. Rick never saw those things. I always got the pamphlets out, and I was the one that read them, and I decided that, you know, I would be okay if he would get sober. And so I did a lot of talking to some, there was this one woman, well, in the morning I'd drop the kids off, and then I'd go to work, and then on our lunch hour, we always stop and buy some booze and go over to this guy's house and his wife, and every day I'd complain about, I wish he would get sober, you know, I'd come home and all the doors would be open, you know, just lots of little things, and it would really piss me off, so I started complaining to Sue, and she goes, you know, if you want him to get sober, maybe you need to get sober too. And that woman today is out still drinking and using, and I kind of listened to that, and I kind of didn't, because my very first meeting was an Al-Anon meeting. I told Nita, yeah, Rick has a problem, and can you take me to an Al-Anon meeting? And I went to that, and then the next day I just, well, I guess it was a little bit, maybe at the next week, but because that was on a Tuesday, and then the next week it was on a Sunday, and I had put my children to bed, and that feeling of, you know, what an order. I just was so totally, I thought my life was just hell, and it was. I had, that was the summer that we had bought a house. I had two kids that I loved. I had a husband I loved. I had everything I thought I always needed that would make me whole, and I was just dying inside. And I went, I put my kids to bed, and we have a park across the street from us, and I just said, and I didn't even know if I believed in God at that time. I just said, please, if you are there, I can't do this anymore. And that was the first night of my sobriety. And then I called my sister-in-law and I told her that I really have a problem. And she took me to my first AA meeting, and what I started to talk about was my husband. They go, oh, honey, don't worry about your husband. Just you worry about you. And that really helped me a lot. And someone saying, you know, you've done a lot of things that you're not proud of. You've done a lot of things that you don't, you know, that you didn't like, but it doesn't mean you're a bad person. And I always thought I was a bad person. And so I went to a meeting every day. My sister-in-law gave me a big book that she had fished out of the trash at the hospital. And I didn't read any of the first, you know, they say you're supposed to read the first 164 pages. I read the stories first. And the first story I read was about the woman who, you know, wherever she went, she took herself with her. And I just knew that I belonged. That first meeting that I went to, they started talking about a topic, and when they found out I was a newcomer, they talked about the first step, that, you know, we admitted we were powerless. And everybody kind of told how they came to believe that they were alcoholic, and these people were laughing, and it gave me so much hope. But this woman had cirrhosis of the liver, and she was laughing, and I thought, oh my God, these people are sick. And we are sick, you know, but that's, God, I think that's what makes us so healthy, is that we can laugh about what we've done. And so I went to a meeting every day. I am truly blessed with having my sister-in-law in the program and having someone that took me every day. And then I thought that, you know, you go to meetings and you see these steps and traditions on the wall, and it just kind of happened to you. I didn't realize that you had to do it, you know, that you had to do the work that goes along with it. And so when I was about 20 days sober, I thought, this is all there is. I don't want it. So I went into inpatient treatment for a month, and that kind of, that helped me a lot. And from the time that I first got sober, when I quit drinking, you know how you go through the shakes and the sweats, and I had, it felt like I had little bugs biting me and that, and I had these horrible sweats and nightmares and stuff, and I thought, God, this is just how I felt when I used to get pregnant, because when I would get pregnant, I would quit. When I had quit because I was pregnant, I didn't realize that at those times I was going through withdrawals. I thought, phew, I'm not pregnant again, though. And I just talked about me to my husband. I just told him everything that I was feeling, and he was still drinking, and I remember we went home to visit my mom and my dad. My dad was dying, and my brother was getting married. And we walked in the door, and my mom said, the first thing I said is, Mom, I'm an alcoholic. I can't drink anymore. She goes, oh, honey, you're not an alcoholic. I got all the stuff to make margaritas with. And I don't know if to this day she believes I'm alcoholic, but I said, I can't. And then she says to my husband, well, you didn't quit, did you? And he goes, no. So he drank beer with her while we were there. And then when we came back and he listened to me about how I was feeling, he says, you know, I feel all that stuff too. And so I have 1 month longer of sobriety than him. And it was a truly a blessing that we both got sober and we stayed together. A lot of people that we either went through family care with or people I went through treatment with are no longer together. And when your relationship revolves around alcohol and, you know, just doing your life, how that goes, you have no idea who each other are. And it was like we had to get to know each other. And then, let's see, my kids were 2.5 and 4.5 when I got sober, and And I did the things to them that I said I would never do to my kids when they were happening to me. I was a screamer and a yeller, and everything was their fault. And they were afraid of me. And that, I always said I never hit my kids. I remember hitting my daughter one time, and that was right at the end of my drinking. And everything I said I would never do, I did. And thank God that there's a way I can not have to do that anymore. And I started, when I was in treatment, they really pushed AA meetings, and I'd already been going to some, so I kind of knew which ones I liked. And they said that treatment is discovery, but AA is recovery. And so I started going to meetings, and this one meeting I went to, you know, if you're a newcomer and you've been there for a little bit, they'll elect you to do something. So I became treasurer for that meeting. And then there was a women's meeting that I went to every week. And then there was a meeting on Wednesday night that it was an ALEC kids meeting, and my daughter would go to that, and my son and I would sit out in the hallway because he wasn't old enough. And then when he was three, he was able to go. So they would go to their ALEC kids meeting, and then I would go to my AA meeting. And that was our life. And they went with me on Sunday mornings because my husband worked nights and he would sleep on Sunday mornings. And they thought it was so cool to go around and empty ashtrays and wipe tables off. And, you know, they would take their coloring book and crayons, and it was a family deal. And they were so good. And I remember one of our neighbors, the guy that lived behind us was a real, really bad alcoholic. And I remember him saying, "Would you like a beer, Carol?" As he, and anyway, my daughter, who's 4 and a half at that time, stops her little tiny bike and she goes, "My mom can't drink that stuff." And I said, "No, that's okay. No, I'm not going to." And our life, you know, started getting better. I had no idea how to be a parent. They have classes for people like me at the hospital. They're called parenting classes, and there was people in the program who had children, and I watched how they raised their kids, and I watched the love, I watched the hugs, and you know, Bob was talking last night about not growing up without hugs and stuff, and we hug each other, and I remember even as a senior, I go to my daughter's swim meets, and she would come over and give me a big hug, and then run off again, and what a beautiful thing that is to have that. And let's see, and you know, I just kept coming, you know, suiting up and showing up, and going to meetings and volunteering, and you know, you just kind of at one meeting you're in a group rep, and then that time ends, so then for another group, you know, it just kind of everything with me anyway. I just had to stay active, and because it's been a really important part of my sobriety. And one of the things that I never got caught for DWI, I never got busted for a lot of the stuff I should have done. I had warrants up for my arrest for bad checks because I used to write a lot of bad checks. The one that I had a warrant out, I wrote 38 bad checks. It was over $2,500. And I cleaned up all that stuff. And one of the things that I've been able to make amends with that way is by volunteering out at the correctional center for people who want to go to meetings and that, and sponsor those people. I have a woman I'm sponsoring now that motor vehicle homicide, and you know, that could have been me. I was thinking about this last night. You know, they're doing my time for me, and they may not stay sober, but it's a seed planted with all those people. And I stayed sober. You know, I guess that's the whole point, is that I'm the one that stays sober. Now my daughter went away to college last year, and that was the best thing for both of us. It was hard. It was really hard. It was really hard. Harder for me than I thought it would be. And you have such a bond with your kids, you know. It's like I never thought I would experience that, and And I have a son who's 17 that on and off has been kind of working on a story. And I, around the first of the year, I remember my daughter was home from school, and she had just had kind of a blow-up with her brother about you're going to ruin your life and all that. And she laid in bed and cried and described in vivid detail rememberings of when I was drinking and using when she was before she was 4 years old. And I, you know, if we think we don't hurt other people, it's not true. We hurt those tiny children. I am so glad. And the only thing I could say to her when we're laying in bed crying and I'm hugging her is that the only thing I can do is live my life differently. And I have. And it's been watching, you know, people who have their kids. And, you know, I did a thing at they had a class on raising responsible teens. And I am by no means a perfect person. I scream and yell still. I say the F word. I am definitely not perfect. You know, listening to Howard read the long version of the traditions, I think that was really neat. I haven't read the long version in a long time, and that's how we got the short version. And I'm really nervous. This whole deal about being... Oh, and I forgot to tell you, I did have another child in sobriety. She's 13 now. And when she was about 11, we were watching a show on TV, and it was talking about people going to AA meetings, and she goes, "Will you go to those?" And I said, "Yeah." She goes, "Well, I thought you went to those so you wouldn't smoke anymore." So she doesn't know, you know, she doesn't live through any of it, but she lives with my isms still. I may be a recovering alcoholic, but my kids are still children of an alcoholic, and they'll probably all need help. I think that, you know, one of the things that I do, pretty much everything that I did when I first got sober, I go to 4 meetings a week. I have a Tuesday home group, and we have a Thursday meeting too. I go to a meeting on Sunday nights. I go to a women's meeting on Saturday, and I'm involved in a women's retreat that we've been having for the last few years, and that's been really, really good. Women I didn't like at all before I got sober, and women are my heroes now. I get totally empowered by other women and see how they do their lives. And on our last retreat, we almost burnt the place down. Almost. It was like $4,500 worth of damage that our group is responsible for, only half the deductible, so it's only like $600. So we've been sending out flyers and, you know, going to have a garage sale or, you know, but that, in sobriety, we have to be responsible. You know, we have to pay our debts, and that's part of, you know, even in sobriety, you can make mistakes. And I think that's the, you know, the first time I worked through the steps, when you're in treatment, you work through 1 through 5. And I do 1, 2, and 3 all the time. And it was probably until I was 4 years sober that I could say the word God. I called him HP. And then when I went on and did my amends in that, there are some of the amends I didn't make because I did them in my fifth step, so I didn't need to. And when I was 4 years sober, the one of, stealing from my work and stealing from my grandfather, that was the hardest one because, it says where it would injure them or others, and he didn't know. And I had to, it kept coming back to me and coming back to me, so I knew I had to tell him that I stole from him and pay him back. And this is where my God has a sense of humor. I picked the time and everything, and I was telling him, and he goes, "What? I can't hear you. My hearing aid battery went out." So I had to yell what I did, and I watched him crumple in the chair, and I didn't cry because with me that was always, if I could cry and make you feel sorry for me, then that was another way to manipulate you, and I took it, you know, I just took it, and I went home and I cried. And when I went to his funeral, I didn't have any regrets. I didn't have that feeling of, oh, I wish I had made my amends to him. I made my amends to my dad. He died when I was 3 months sober. And I did those amends without expecting anything in return, and that was a gift. That was just a gift. And I made my amends to my mom, and she goes, "I don't want to hear it." So, and that's just how my mom is. So, and you know, they say that the steps are a wheel; they're not a ladder. And I've worked through the steps many times, and now I'm going through the steps again with my sponsor. And I just did another fourth and fifth. And you know, that ego and that pride—that's what gets me in trouble. That's what I think. That's probably the root of all my everything. And that's been a real blessing. My one sponsor moved a few years ago, and then I had kind of a sponsor in town, but I still use Susan and Rapid, you know, when stuff would come up, and then Terry came into my life, and that was a real God thing. I'm just really grateful for that, and I don't really have anything else to say. I just wanted to read a poem to you that I found when I was about 5 days sober, and it was after coming into these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and listening to people and just kind of watching you that I thought this was written for me. It says, "You believed in me when I couldn't in myself. You told me it would get better when I suspected only worse. You held me when I couldn't touch myself. You showed me laughter when all I did was cry inside. You guided me toward health when all I seemed to have was sickness. You lived one day at a time when I muddled through a lifetime. You flowed with courage when I stagnated in fear. When I was so fearful, muddled, sick, crying, alone, pessimistic, and doubtful, it was real all and only me. That what I was, I am no more. I prayed for death. You helped to let me live. I hoped for oblivion. You showed me vigor. I existed in hell. You gave me the tools to build a heaven. I quested in solitude. You helped present me friends. I revolved in chaos. You helped show me serenity. I damned the world and myself. You said I could find a loving God. I lived in inner war. You helped give me inner peace. I came, I asked for help, and you gave. Thank you very much."